episode of Progress, Potential, and Possibilities, discussions with fascinating people designing a better tomorrow for all of us. I'm your host, Ira Pastor.
Today we are honored to be joined by none other than Dr. Leonard Hayflick, professor of anatomy, University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, where he has been part of the faculty since 1988. Dr. Hayflick received his PhD here in Philadelphia at Penn, did his postdoctoral work at University of Texas under the tutelage of the renowned cell culturist Professor Charles Pombrot, and then he returned to Philly, where he spent 10 years as an associate member of the Wister Institute and 2 years as assistant professor of research medicine at Penn. Dr. Hayflick is extremely well known in our life sciences world for a wide range of research, including the domains of cell biology, viral vaccine development, mycoplasmology. In 1962, he discovered that, contrary to what was believed since the turn of the century, that cultured normal cells and human and animal have a limited capacity to replicate. This phenomenon ultimately became known as the Hayflick limit, which became a discovery that overturned dogma that existed since the beginning of the 20th century and really focused the attention of the cell as this fundamental location of age-related changes. Dr. Hayflick is a member of numerous national and international scientific and public boards of directors and committees. He is now or has been on editorial boards of more than 10 professional journals, including editor-in-chief of Experimental Gerontology. He's a member of 20 scientific and professional societies in which he has held high offices, including president of the Gerontological Society of America, founding member of the Council of the National Institute on Aging, NIH at the NIH, and chairman of the executive committee, consultant to the National Cancer Institute, to the World Health Organization, and member of several scientific advisory boards. He was also the chairman of the Scientific Review Board of the American Federation for Aging Research, where he's also a vice president and member of its board of directors. He is the author of the very popular book, How and Why We Age. And also, during his career, was consultant at Genentech from early on in its inception for a few decades after that, where one component of his amazing research, namely that for cell culture and growing animal cells in fermentation tanks for large-scale production of biologics, was responsible for Genentech's billion-dollar blockbuster biologics throughout the decades. A lot to talk about. Dr. Hayflick, thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to come talk to us for a little while.
You're welcome. Nice to see you.
It's good seeing you. Typically, we start the show off by giving our guests the floor to talk a little bit about themselves. I was hoping I could ask you to start off with like two places. One, if you could sort of take us back to sort of Depression era Philadelphia, where you're growing up, and sort of how you developed this original interest in science, in biomedicine, and also if you could take us to sort of mid-20th century Philly, back to sort of that Wister Penn biomedical ecosystem where we had Len Hayflick, Hilary Kaprowski, Stan Plotkin. I don't know if Jonas Salk ever stopped by to say hi, but if you could take us back to what things were like back in those days as well. Like, you've got to make a really, really great introduction to who you are.
Well, my early interest in science, I think, was triggered by a gift made to me when I was about, I think, 8 or 9 years old by an uncle who gave me, I guess for my birthday, a Gilbert chemistry set. Some of those folks who are in my age cohort will remember Gilbert chemistry sets. And it contained, as the name indicates, a bunch of chemicals, small amounts, with an instruction book on how to do so-called experiments. And that triggered my interest in chemistry that was maintained for quite some time, during which time I built a chemistry lab in the basement of my home in West Philadelphia on, where was it? It must have been on Florence Avenue, and I don't think it was Warrington, which preceded that, but it was on Florence Avenue in Southwest Philly. And my mother was very liberal, as my father was, in respect to what they allowed me to do. So there was no difficulty in constructing this lab with shelves containing lots of chemicals. And I obtained even more chemicals in later years from various sources, pharmacies, etc. And did the usual kinds of experiments that you expect a young kid to do, made explosives and flares and stuff like that, annoyed the neighbors significantly. But I learned a heck of a lot of chemistry on my own with that as the source. And I even got to the point of annoying my high school chemistry teacher, who I had the chutzpah to correct on one or two occasions. And he was so impressed, first of all, with my knowledge, and secondly, that I would have the guts to criticize him in front of the class, that he banished me to the laboratory stockroom, which was a big mistake because there were lots of chemicals there that I didn't have. And so I admit to the theft of tiny amounts of half a dozen or so of the chemicals that I didn't have, and learned more about those half a dozen, spent the course time in the stockroom. And that was fortunate. The chemistry teacher was actually very good. I respected him a great deal. And I also had some very good physics teacher at Bartram High School, where I attended for my high school years. And then I had very good marks in high school. And I won a scholarship to Temple University, which was fairly significant. But I turned it down because I had this impression, rightly or wrongly, that Penn was better. I'm not sure about that, but at least I thought in the sciences they might be able to, I might be better off at Penn. And so I enrolled at Penn, and that was in January of 1946, a strange time to begin at Penn, but things were changed around because it was the end of the Second World War, and at least the active end, legal end, didn't occur until later. It turned out that my parents were unable to pay the $350 per semester tuition. We were just recovering from the Depression, of course. And as a consequence of that, I took advantage of the then 18-month enlistment possibility in the U.S. Army to get the GI Bill of Rights, which was a huge thing because it would pay in full for 4 years at Penn. So I took leave of absence, joined the Army technically 5 days before it officially ended on May 15th, 1946, and spent 18 months in the Army, got the GI Bill, attended Penn, majored in chemistry and microbiology, and then decided to accept a position that my professor of microbiology had found for me at what was called Sharp and Dome at the time, outside of Philadelphia. I forget the name of the community now. But I knew that that when I was hired by them, that Sharp and Dome entity would be merged with Merck, and my labs would move to West Point, Pennsylvania, north of Philadelphia. So I joined that unit. And when we got to West Point, Pennsylvania. I commuted with a fellow who also lived nearby me in Southwest Philly. Incidentally, I was unable for financial reasons to live in the dorms of Penn, so I commuted to Penn by trolley car from West Philadelphia, where I lived. So I really didn't have the kind of college experience or university experience that most people have. In any case, to get back to my year or two at Merck and West Point, where I met my wife, actually. And after experiencing interactions with the PhDs there at Sharp and Dohme, and I thought I was unable to reach that level of education, I then realized, after interacting with many of these senior scientists there, since I was in the research lab as a technician, I realized that I might have the ability to get a higher degree. So I applied to Penn's Department of Medical Microbiology in the medical school, and I was accepted, and was very interested in a obscure group of microorganisms then, and even to this day. At that time, they were called pleuropneumonia-like organisms, and the name changed. Today, they're known as mycoplasmas. They're the smallest free-living microorganisms. You cannot see them with an ordinary light microscope individually. You can't see their colonies on agar, however. And I became fascinated with that group of organisms. Ultimately got a master's degree that I served at the Wistar Institute Animal Laboratory, the famous Wistar rat colony, famous because it was there in the early part of the 1900s that a woman scientist actually invented or grew the first albino white rats that served as the origin of all of the white rats used in experimental laboratories throughout the world. They were thought to be inbred, which was one of their major advantages. However, later on, when the Institute was taken over by Hilary Kaprowski, he brought along with him, I'm blocking on his name now, a fellow who tested, it was an expert in the genetics of inbreeding, and he discovered that in fact they were not inbred, which was a disaster for many people. But to get back to my role, I got my master's degree in the Wistar rat colony, where I isolated for the first time in the field mycoplasmas. Prior to that, only laboratory strains existed at Penn, which had a large number of people in the microbiology department studying these organisms. And I went on to get my PhD under rather unusual circumstances, some funny anecdotes that might be of interest, and that is that the medical school at that time, of course, was part of the original medical school building built in the late 1800s. And I had a very primitive lab along with another graduate student who worked with me. And I was planning to continue my work with the mycoplasmas, but my mentor, who was an assistant professor and didn't technically have the capacity to have graduate students, although that was permitted by circumventing the rules and having my other student in the lab with me, officially the students of Stuart Mudd, who was chairman of the Department of Medical Microbiology at that time, a wonderful man with lots of interesting stories about him that I went to, but he was just a wonderful liberal guy who suffered enormously because either his father or his grandfather was the Dr. Mudd who treated the John Wilkes Booth.
Mm.
And that blemished, he had to suffer for years, at least people who knew the story. So getting back to a more significant point in my career was that Warren Steinbring, which is the name of my assistant professor, mentor, a practical mentor, he just returned from the first cell culture course given in this country in New York State at a small hospital in upper New York State. And he came back from that course full of enthusiasm about culturing animal and human cells in vitro in bottles and flasks. And he persuaded me to become interested in that area as well. I was reluctant, but because he was my boss, I decided to compromise, and I said, okay, I'll do a PhD dissertation with the mycoplasmas in tissue culture to see how their behavior is in tissue culture. He agreed, and that got me started in the field of cell culture. This was in 53, 52, something in that region. And that got me interested in cell culture that remained with me pretty much for my entire career. Dr. Steinbring was then able to get me a postdoc in the laboratory of Charlie Pomerantz at the University of Texas in Galveston, which was a huge event because Pomerantz was a world leading authority on cell culture, from whom I learned quite a bit. And it was from there that I moved to the Wistar Institute in 1958 after my fellowship at the University of Texas ended. And I learned from one of my former professors to whom I wrote for information on permanent positions. And that person was Werner Henley, a very well-known virologist, he and his wife, Gertrude Henley. And Werner wrote back and said that a man by the name of Hilary Kaprowski was taking over the Wistar Institute, which was in decline for many, many years. Although sad to say, even to this day, the Wistar leadership does not recognize one of the key events that occurred there at about the time that I was there as a master's degree student in the animal colony. And that was a unit on the top floor of this three-story building headed by a man by the name of Dr. Edmund Farris. He ran artificial insemination unit in the United States. Mm-hmm. Where he had the major advantage of having available to him the Wistar rats, which meant that he could use the virgin female rats to conduct the Asheim-Zondek test, which is a test in which, in the case of humans, a woman's morning urine inoculated into the ovaries of a virgin female rat would, if she was ovulating, show that presence by enlargement of the veins that ran around the ovaries of the virgin female rat. And so of a woman, and then using sperm donors could result in significant successes in pregnancies. And I remember several women at that time who were walking up the interior steps at the Wistar Institute with a big smile on their face, carrying a young baby and going in to thank Ed Farris for the work that he had done. Ed got in a lot of trouble because he also was expert in research on sperm, on male sperm. And he discovered that many men and many of those who did not father the infants that I just described, but who were married to those women, of course, that they suffered from impaired sperm, either motility problems or configuration problems. And he voiced the then unique opinion that, contrary to the universal belief of all physicians at that time, it was possible that a sterile, that a marriage that resulted in no children was in fact the result of men and not women, which was universally believed. And that got him in big trouble with the medical establishment, not only because of his discovery, but because he was a PhD and not an MD. And this is all a matter of public record. I can give reference to this information. But his institution finally folded because some enterprising newspaper reporters got a hold of this unique story about this institute, and it traveled to the ears of some religious leaders in Philadelphia, who also leaned on Ed Farris to close his facility. Very sad story, because the women and men who benefited from that insemination center were had their lives changed in a very happy way to have children of their own, which they otherwise couldn't have. It was getting back, that was an aside from my hiring as a cell culturist by Hilary Kaprowski at Wistar. And I was hired to run a tissue culture laboratory at Wistar, to serve the needs of the then senior members of the Institute. The senior members, unlike me, were Hillary's scientific associates at, I believe it was Letterly Laboratories. Mm-hmm. And they were brought there from Letterly, and Hillary was putting them in the highest positions. When he hired me, I was not a senior member of the Institute, and I was hired more to run this service laboratory. But I knew what he must have known, but didn't voice it. That is that as the director of that service laboratory, I would have, after hopefully being successful in running it, which I was able to do less than a year, I would then have free time to conduct my own research in cell culture, which I intended to do, without the burden of grant applications, because the materials that I wanted to use in the research that I was interested in, it was available to me in this service lab, mostly materials that would otherwise be discarded. So that was a huge plus. And I undertook a research program, which was as follows. Do you want me to continue? I think you had another question.
No, I'm going to go into the Hayflick limit and sort of the, you know,
I'm about to describe that, but please, you said something earlier about Philadelphia during the Depression.
No, this is great because I love how you've gone from the Depression into, you know, post-World War II and sort of the amazing amount of things that we read about in the history books, but that were happening down the street here. And I mean, obviously you and I are both Philly boys growing up, but
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
Good.
So I'll continue.
Please.
Okay. So I was interested in, at that time when I started this new lab, and I should say parenthetically that Hillary raised an enormous sum of money to renovate the Wistar Institute laboratories, which were from the 19th century. And I, as all the people there, ended up with beautiful new labs. And I had a large cell culture laboratory with what we called sterile rooms, which are two or three rooms at either end of the large laboratory that were had air filtered through HEPA filters, which means that they held back viruses and bacteria and other larger entities. And so I had a very good laboratory. So the research project that I decided to do within less than a year of establishing the service lab was to take advantage of the knowledge that existed then, or new knowledge, that some animals, mainly rodents, were found to have cancers produced by viruses. That was not entirely new because Peyton Rouse, a well-known name, at least in those days, who ultimately became part of my professional life that I'll mention later, that Peyton Rouse discovered the viral etiology of a tumor of cancers, a particular kind of cancers in chickens. In any case, that fascinated me, and I decided to do a very simple-minded experiment. I decided to grow human tumor tissue, cancer tissue, that I could obtain from across the street at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. And I would grow those tumor tissues. And then by the extraction methods that were then known to be successful in isolating oncogenic or cancer-causing viruses for laboratory animals, or rodents in particular, that I would adapt those extraction methods on the human-grown cancer cells and expose the extracts to normal human cells in culture to see whether I could convert them, the technical term is transform them, into cancer cells. That was a simple-minded experiment. Well, it was very easy through my association with Isidore Ravdin at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital, a very well-known surgeon and medical leader at the hospital at that time. I got to know him through Hillary, the director of the Institute, the Wistar Institute, and he was able to arrange for me to get tumor tissue. The next, which was relatively simple, the next problem was to get a normal human tissue, which is not easily surrendered by people who are well. But I learned by this time of a serious problem that could lie within the cells obtained from human adults. And that is, often they would contain ordinary viruses, like maybe that were hiding there, like even rubella germ, measles, or many other viruses that I won't go into details now, that would, if present in the adult human cells that I thought I would use, would confound my work, because I was looking for a cancer virus. It was also known that human fetal cells were clean of these unwanted contaminating viruses. And so I focused on trying to obtain human fetal tissue, which was not easy. Finally, with proper connections, again at the hospital at Penn, I decided to, I arranged to get fetuses that were surgically aborted or spontaneously aborted at Penn. And that was the source of the fetal cells, mostly derived from human fetal lung, that I intended to use to apply the extracts upon, derived from the human tumor tissue. So I began to grow the normal human fetal lung cells, and obviously the availability of the fetuses was random. I would get a phone call, sadly, and usually Friday at 5 p.m., that a human fetus was available. I should come over and get it. And that event occurred at random times. Of course, it couldn't be planned. And I would set cultures of fibroblasts from the lungs of each of those fetuses. And after having, let's say, a dozen of them, one day I walked into the incubator room. Next to my laboratory was a large room, temperature kept at 37 degrees Celsius, or about 98 degrees Fahrenheit, which of course, as one might expect, would be the ideal temperature to grow human cells and other cells as well. So I walked, and I had a shelf assigned to me on which my cultures were kept, and others had other shelf assignments. I walked, and I had the habit of going in to look at my cultures every day or two. And one day I walked in and saw one culture that was seemed to have stopped dividing. And that was no surprise, because at that time, people were well aware of the difficulties of culturing cells and the common observance of failure. And I thought, well, this one is failing for some reason. I don't know what it is, but I'll just accept it. A couple days later, a week later, I find another culture showing the same phenomenon. That is cessation of mitotic activity, the cessation of division capacity. And I got a little more interested in this. Couldn't understand what was going on, but it still didn't trigger my curiosity sufficiently until, again, for the third and the fourth time, I saw these luxuriantly growing cultures stop dividing. Looked at my laboratory notebook and made the discovery that the ones that had stopped dividing were the cultures that were set, that were in culture longest. In other words, the fetuses were received 10 or 11 months ago, while the ones received within the last month or two were growing luxuriantly in the same pool of media, same group of glassware, and cultured by the same technician, so the likelihood of some artifact emerging was remote. And this triggered my curiosity. It wasn't a eureka moment. It was gee, that's funny moment. So I became so much interested in that phenomenon and what was causing it that I abandoned the original research on human cancer viruses that I described. And I decided to do an experiment that would hopefully dispose of the beliefs that were widespread at that time when cultures failed, that my cultures failed for some artifact like a virus or bacterial contamination or media errors in media formulation. All of those excuses were invoked by people whose cultures failed. Fortunately, my colleague, Paul Moorhead, who I brought actually had arranged to be hired by Hillary from Pomerantz Lab where we met, Paul Moorhead was a cytogeneticist. And at that time, it was just discovered, believe it or not, that humans had 46 chromosomes and not 42, as was believed. I believe I got that right because I grew up knowing one set of chromosomes and then had to adapt to the new discovery. In any case, the more important fact is that Paul could distinguish with techniques available at that time between male and female cells because female cells had an inactive X of the two X's. And that inactive X could be stained during interphase. That is during the time that the cells were not in a state of division, which was most of the time. And with that marker, I did the following experiment. The discovery that was earlier made was that the fetal cells could undergo between 40 and 60 population doublings before they stopped dividing. That was the that's funny moment story. So I took female cells, which we could identify, of course, at the, let's say, 20th population doubling out of the 50, and mixed them with an equal number of male cells, let's say at the 40th doubling, and keep unmixed controls going side by side, and keep the mixture going, of course, subcultivating them every 3 or 4 days, which would represent 1 or 2 population doublings. And then I found that the male control culture showed the phenomenon that I described, in which the male control culture showed the cells stop dividing. So I looked at the mixture and found only female cells, because the female cells had overgrown the male cells and they just disappeared in subsequent subcultivations. And the female control culture was still growing luxuriantly. Well, that proved rather significantly that whatever could be invoked as the cause of the cessation of division in normal human cells, fetal cells after 40 to 60 doublings, had to know how to distinguish between male and female cells. Because if it was an artifact of culture or media construction, then that would have to play a role only in the male cells and not in the female cells, which continued to luxuriate. And that was pretty conclusive evidence that this phenomenon that I discovered was an intracellular phenomenon that had nothing to do with extracellular events like bad media, bad culturing techniques, phases of the moon, or anything that people invoked up until that time. So I called it the dirty old man experiment because we mixed young female cells with old male cells. But I can assure you that the dirty old lady experiment gave the same results. So I decided that we should publish this work. And the main concern of several, but one of the main concerns was to be sure that this wasn't an artifact, because as word leaked out about my results and my interpretation, after excluding everything else that I could think of, my interpretation was that this was aging or senescence at the cellular level, which was simply a kind of wastebasket where I threw something into that I otherwise could not explain. So that's where the association of my discovery with aging or senescence at the cellular level came about. I was also very concerned about this discovery because it violated a dogma that existed for 60 years at the birth of cell culture, the early part of the 20th century. And all of my superiors, leaders in the field and others, everybody else in the field believed that all cells in culture are immortal. Regardless of their source, they have the potential for immortality, so I must have made a mistake. Well, this was of such concern that I decided to send cultures of one of my cell strains to several of the leaders in the field, Harry Eagle, who I knew, George Guy, the discoverer of the HeLa cells, actually it was his wife, who I also knew, and several other well-known characters in the field. And I said, I'm sending you these cultures. Do me the favor of culturing them, because I can tell you that although we're now in the month of June, that in the month of December or November, these cultures will fail, regardless of your superior culturing capabilities. Well, they poo-pooed that idea. And sure enough, the phone rang in November and December from Harry and from George, saying that the cell cultures that I had sent to them had stopped dividing. So I felt relieved, believing that if I went down in flames, I would have some significant personality going down in flames along with me. And I decided to publish. Wrote the paper, and the paper included a number of other things. It included the virus spectrum of the cells, which was very significant, as it later turned out, because I discovered that these human cells were particularly sensitive to the growth and isolation of human viruses. And I listed in this first paper all of the viruses that I could grow in these cells, which meant all of the then known human viruses, and several other aspects of their culture characteristics. So the paper I decided to send to the Cadillac of journals at that time, which was called the Journal of Experimental Medicine, published from the Rockefeller Institute at that time, and for several other reasons. Another reason I sent the paper there was because it was the place where Alexis Carrel published his work, a famous scientist in the mid-20th century who claimed that he could culture chick heart cells up to 43 years nonstop. Mm. And he interpreted that to support the general dogma that cells in culture had the potential to be immortal, regardless of their origin. Well, that I decided later from a series of incidents that I won't discuss now unless I'm asked to. I had reason to believe that Carrel's work was wrong, that the methods of culturing that he used, in which the nutrient material for his allegedly immortal cell population was actually contaminated periodically with chick cells from the chick embryo material that he used to feed this so-called immortal population.
Yeah.
So he was introducing new fibroblasts, chick fibroblasts, periodically into this alleged immortal cell population, which incidentally gained international notice in newspapers worldwide who came to Carrel's lab. He was one of the first scientists to realize the value of public notoriety.
Mm.
And in his new lab, he built a balcony for reporters to look down at himself and his technicians, all of whom were gowned in black from head to toe, and in a room painted on all sides, ceiling and floor in black, because of Alexis Carrel's belief as a surgeon that would reduce the likelihood of contamination, which was a serious problem in cell culture in those days. And that lent an air of mysticism around this field of cell culture that even to this day has remnants. But Carrel obtained international recognition for this so-called immortal population. Each January, reporters would arrive in his lab to celebrate its anniversary. One newspaper, the New York, I forget the name of the paper that's now defunct, but it had a headline one year that said, "Dr. Carrel's immortal cell cultures, if all of the cells were kept and not removed, because you couldn't keep all of them if they doubled every 2 or 3 days. If you kept all of the cells that Dr. Carrel grew," the headline in the newspaper read, "it would create a rooster that could cross the Atlantic Ocean in a single stride." Anyhow, my beliefs were later confirmed that either Carrel knew about this error or did not. And there are published papers trying to prove at least that he knew about this, but became so famous because of it, he couldn't reveal the truth. In any case, getting back to the second reason why I chose the Journal of Experimental Medicine to publish my work is because of a major personality alive in the field at that time. Carrel had since died. This gentleman, whose name escapes me at the moment, but I will recall it momentarily. He had also been working with normal human cells and published his work in this journal, but never saw the phenomena that I did. I won't go into the details now, but I will subsequently if required. For those two reasons, I sent the paper to this journal. And after several months, it was rejected with a letter claiming, first of all, and I think I can quote the letter verbatim. The letter said, "If there is any truth to come out of cell culture, it's that a culture provided with the proper media has the capacity to replicate indefinitely." And secondly, he wrote, the suggestion that this you can interpret this work to have anything to do with aging is, quote, notably rash, end quote. The letter was signed by Peyton Rouse, the gentleman I mentioned earlier, who was well known for his discovery of the viral etiology of chicken pathology, and who 6 months later, after signing that letter, won the Nobel Prize, meant that I was very depressed. And at the suggestion of Hilary Kaprowski, my boss, the letter, the paper written by myself and Paul Moorhead was sent to Sweden to the journal called Experimental Cell Research. And that paper was published without any changes almost immediately and has now been cited 7,000 times, which if for those scientists who are viewing this will know is pretty much a record that's rarely been exceeded. The second paper that I wrote on the subject, in which I found that cells from human adults went through fewer replications than cells from younger adults, that paper has, I think, up to today about 5,000 to 6,000 citations. And these two papers were assigned to be citation classics in the Institute for Scientific Information, then located in Philadelphia, and headed by Eugene Garfield, now unfortunately deceased. So the paper was very successful, although I should say that it took at least 10 years for the general cell culture and biological community to accept what I had discovered. I also became interested, after having proven at least to myself that there was an intracellular counting mechanism, decided to do experiments to find out more about this mysterious intracellular counting mechanism, which manifested itself in a most unusual way. That is, if the cell cultures that had a 50 doubling potential were frozen at any population doubling from 1 to 50, and then reconstituted months or years later, even to this day, 58 years later, they remember what doubling level they were when frozen and replicated beyond that number to 50 after reconstitution. So the cells had this remarkable capacity of memory without a brain. So there must be a counting mechanism. In pursuit of that goal, Dr. Woodring Wright, a former student of mine, and I discovered that this counting mechanism was in the nucleus of the cell, of normal cells. I also discovered and reported in that paper another important finding, and that is that because I knew that normal cells had a finite capacity to replicate, I also realized that the only cells that had a capacity for immortality, that is, unlimited replicative capacity, were cancer or tumor cancer cells. And that gave birth to the new field of cell immortalization, where cancer researchers are looking for the reasons at the molecular level why cells, normal cells, become cancer cells and obtain this capacity of immortality. In closing this aspect of the story, I should mention that the molecular explanation for my phenomenological discoveries was made about 10 years after my discoveries by Elizabeth Blackburn and Carol Greider and Shostak, although he was not directly involved, the two ladies were, who discovered that after an accidental meeting of that Carol Greider had with one of my scientific grandchildren, Cal Harley, at McMaster University in Canada. She visited her husband, her boyfriend at that time there, met Cal Harley, my student, or at least in theory, and they both discussed each other's work and decided to do a critical experiment. I won't go into the details of why they decided to do this, but each didn't know the other's work. Cal Harley worked with my system of limited replicative capacity normal cells. And he and Carol decided to do a key experiment in which she had the knowledge of telomere attrition. And they discovered in a famous paper soon to be published, or then later published in Science, that the telomeres in my cultured cells reduced in length at each doubling and reached a point that sent a downstream message to the DNA to stop cell replication. And Liz Blackburn later discovered the enzyme telomerase, which now explained my discovery of why cancer cells are immortal. That is, the normal cells which from which they emerged express the enzyme telomerase, which lays on the parts of the telomeres that are removed at each doubling in normal cells. And by replacing the lost ones, telomerase provides the cell with the property of immortality. So that comes pretty much to a point of closure, but I should mention one other thing since you mentioned my role in the field of mycoplasmology, that about the same year that I made this discovery of finite lifetime of culture of normal cells, I was also still working with the mycoplasmas. In fact, I got a strong memo from Hilary Kaprowski, copy of which I still have, in which Hilary said, "Hey Flick, you were hired to run a cell culture laboratory and not to continue your work with the mycoplasma. Please cease and desist." Well, those who know my personality know that I do not accept authority with great pleasure and continued my work until Bob Chanek arrived in my laboratory. He knew Hilary Kaprowski and wanted Hilary to have me provide Bob with a culture of my normal human cells, which are so by that time well known for their ability to culture viruses. And Bob Chanek was working on an alleged virus disease of humans called primary atypical pneumonia, better known to most people as walking pneumonia. In fact, I read recently some leading politician in this country recently was bedridden with walking pneumonia after suffering from it for some weeks. In any case, Bob and I got chatting while I was having a technician arrange a culture to be packaged for him to take back NIH where he worked. And Bob said, I asked him what he's working on. He said, I'm working with something called the Eaton agent, which is supposedly the cause of primary atypical pneumonia, but it's never been isolated as a virus, despite the fact that it's carried in embryonated chicken eggs, the only way that it could be cultured. The person associated with the agent at that time was a man by the name of Monroe Eaton, who worked at Harvard University. And what neither of them knew, and what I knew when Bob related the story to me, was that many ordinary animals suffer from pneumonia caused by a mycoplasma. And I said to Bob, have you ever looked at this agent, allegedly but never proven to be a virus, to be a PPLO, which is what they were called at that time? He said, what are PPLOs? So I gave him a course 101 in PPLOology and asked him to send me a culture of this so-called Eaton agent. He sent me the material. I isolated an organism quickly, a mycoplasma, on a media that I had then just developed because I had no faith in the then existing culture media. And later I told Bob what I had found, and he was stunned. He sent people from his lab to my lab at Wistar to train and how to culture these organisms. And we then published a paper because using Koch's postulates, we proved that the agent I discovered, when instilled into the nasal cavities of prisoner volunteers at the clinical center at NIH, produced the disease called walking pneumonia. Yep. The paper was written, and it was received a column on the top fold of the Sunday front page of the New York Times, mentioning my name and Bob's, of course, along with Wistar Institute, which was a big boost for the Wistar Institute to appear on the front page of the New York Times. And on the Monday morning, my lab door opened, and there is my boss, Hillary Kaprowski, standing there with an outstretched hand, wanting to shake mine and congratulating me on my discovery. So that's why I still like to have and show people the memorandum that he wrote for me to cease and desist.
It's a fascinating journey, to say the least. Not only do you lay the ground for modern cancer immortalization research, you anger Alexis Carrel and Hillary Kaprowski, and also you set the stage for something that's happening right now as well in terms of this new sort of pharmacotherapeutic field of senolytics, where a lot of
you're right. Of course, I had no expectation of that happening in my lifetime, but it certainly has. I also should say that I'm not bragging, I'm just stating facts.
Please.
I discovered two other important things. First of all, in the early days of cell culture, the cells are grown in petri dishes or something called Carell flasks, and they're very difficult to use the then existing microscopes to see the cells, because you would need a long working distance lens, which either didn't exist or were very rare to obtain. And in my effort to solve that problem, I discovered that there was an inverted microscope used by crystallographers. I obtained one of these microscopes from a salesman from trying to think of the name of the microscope company, a major microscope company. And he said, well, I'll send you one of these crystallographer microscopes. I said, well, don't do that yet. I said, have your people converted in the following way. And I gave him instructions about how I would like to have it made. They made it. And I then received the first inverted microscope, which was perfect to view cultures by having the objective under the stage. And that microscope became the granddaddy of all current inverted microscopes used in cell culture labs throughout the world. It was accessioned by the Smithsonian Institution, along with packages of vaccines produced in one of my cell strains called WI38, a cell strain that I worked with a normal cell culture at with a finite lifetime that I worked with for many years, and that I failed to mention became the subject of a very important discovery, and that was its use for the manufacture of human virus vaccines. I listened to the discussion that Stanley Plotkin had, but he did not mention in his discovery of the rubella vaccine the enabling technology. The enabling technology was my gifting to him and to Hilary Kaprowski, who produced the best rabies vaccine, which is still in existence, superior to anything ever made, that they were both successful because of my gift to them of WI38. Yeah. It had two major successes in respect to the rubella vaccine that Stanley is given credit for. The passage of the rubella virus that he was working with in WI38 gave to that virus the property of attenuation. That is, the virus retained its antigenic capabilities, that is to produce antibodies in a vaccinated person, but did not retain its capacity to produce the disease, that is the pathogenicity. That was key to his discovery that rubella virus, for which he claims credit, was then capable of being used in the vaccine that was superior to the one that he was competing with, produced by the then called Division of Biologic Standards, which subsequently became, as a result of my congressional testimony, to some extent, moved to the FDA. They were producing a vaccine against the rubella virus produced in primary monkey kidney, which was known to have unacceptable side effects, at least subsequently. But because the DBS, when it came to make a decision between the RA27/3 virus vaccine that Stanley made with using my WI38 cells, in which it's produced even to this day, that the DBS became a judge and jury as to which vaccine would be accepted first. And because they had the choice between their own developed vaccine and Stanley's, they chose obviously their own. And when that became produced by Merck, it showed unacceptable side effects. Merck abandoned it, embraced the vaccine that Stanley made in WI-38, and that became a monopoly even in the entire Western Hemisphere, about which, from which Merck has made billions of dollars. I should also mention something very important.
Please.
And that is that I distributed WI-38 for free to every qualified vaccine manufacturer in the world who asked for it, and virtually all of them did, and to every researcher who asked for it, until it became apparent that I could not afford the cost of sending hundreds of cultures to colleagues all over the world, which would run into the thousands of dollars, which I certainly didn't have. And as a result of that, I charged people a nominal fee for the cost of packaging and mailing the cultures to recipients. The costs were exactly those charged by the American Type Culture Collection, a quasi-governmental organization, that I also had given ampules of WI-38 to very early on. So the cost ranged from $15 to $75 over a period of 15 or 20 years. All of those monies were put into a special bank account to decide who owned those funds, because this was a unique situation in biology. It had never been determined who owned a self-replicating system like WI-38.
Sure.
And without going into all of the details, one of which I'll mention, that is that as a result of my testimony before a Senate investigating committee, headed by Abraham Ribicoff, I testified that DBS, who I mentioned earlier as judge and jury for the rubella vaccine made at Wistar, should not be in the business of being judge and jury because of obvious conflict of interest problems. Mm-hmm. And that they should be moved from the NIH, where they were then located, to the obvious organization, and that's the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
Having it moved to the FDA was accepted by Congress, who then did exactly that. But it made the members of the DBS at NIH angry with me, because it turned them from NIH scientists to what they would then be labeled as FDA controllers, which they felt was a step down. It certainly practically was not. That aggravated, it was one of the compelling reasons why, when I became a candidate for the first director of the National Institute on Aging and asked the then incoming, new incoming director at that time, I asked them to settle a very important matter, or two important matters. First, the title to WI-38, which was in contention, and second, the disposition of the funds that I had kept in a bank account all those years, as to who was entitled to those funds. I asked the leadership of the NIH to send to me their most brilliant lawyer, because the issue of title to a self-duplicating system was never addressed in law. And instead of that, they sent to me an accountant whose knowledge of cell culture and the law was encyclopedic. This about to retire accountant saw an opportunity to crown his dull career by unseating a known scientist, namely me, by accusing me of theft of government property and charging a sum of money for personal gain by selling that property. Well, that immediately caused me to file suit against this, against the people who were making this charge at NIH, FDA, and DHEW at that time. And in addition to that, the government felt so compelled after 10 years of resisting the use of WI-38 for vaccine production in this country, and then becoming so enamored of it as a result of WI-38's successful use in most European countries, decided to confiscate WI-38 from my liquid nitrogen tanks at Stanford University, where I was at the time, and remove them all to Washington and claim them for themselves. So I immediately brought suit against those three federal entities, claiming that there were four stakeholders in cells like these. First of all, the estate of the fetus from which this tissue came. The second stakeholder was the institution where the work was done. The third stakeholder would be any entity that funded the research that I did and the government did not. All of the work that I've described in this interview was done without a NIH grant or contract. It was bootlegged, and the results of my work cannot be attributed to any grant or contract other than an overhead grant to the Wistar Institute in its entirety, made by the NCI in the early 60s. I was not a PI on that, principal investigator. It was Hillary, and it only paid for the lights and the heat and the janitorial services for my lab and all the other labs at the Institute. In any case, my lawsuit was ultimately won by me in an out-of-court settlement after the occurrence of three significant events. The first event was the ruling called the Chakrabarty decision made by the Supreme Court that it was in 1976, that living entities could be patented. Up until that time, you could not patent living things. So I could never patent WI-38. I had to give it away free, which is what I did, except for charging, as I explained, for cost of mailing the culture. The second major statute of limitations had expired, so I cannot patent WI-38. Hillary and Stanley Potkin both patented the process for producing the rabies vaccine and Stanley's rubella vaccine without consulting me, and in the first paragraph of each patent saying that the enabling technology was the availability of WI-38. The Wistar Institute has received $30 million a year from licensing the technology that I described for these vaccines. Hillary Kaprowski and Stanley, I am told by Stanley himself, received remuneration for those vaccine development. Paul Moorhead and I have received zero. Okay, so I'm now wanting to finish this story about the lawsuit. The third thing that happened with this lawsuit that drove the government to ask for an out-of-court settlement because they found themselves in an impossible position was that the NIH itself and most major universities in this country began to realize what monies they could make by licensing the research performed by their faculty members. And so they established in these universities separate entities consisting of lawyers, patent attorney experts to do what I just described.
Yep.
It was unheard of when I was a student. If you had anything to do with money, when I was at Penn, you would be considered a failure. And it was totally unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
You did research to benefit people and not to benefit your pocketbook. And that was completely overturned in the 70s, 80s, and up until this date. The final major thing that happened was that NIH itself held science fairs, they still do annually,
mm-hmm.
to advertise the research work of NIH employees for the sale of what discoveries are made in NIH to commercial organizations. I mean, that was unheard of for decades. If anybody at the NIH did that in the earlier years, they would be imprisoned because you're using taxpayers' money to enrich not only the institute, but the individual scientists who later were and still are to this day could become enriched by discoveries they make at the NIH to get commercially exploited. So the whole community of science has been overturned in ways that emphasize the commercial aspects that were never emphasized in the early years of my career. It's questionable, of course, whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. I think it probably is a good thing, but it, only because it is hopefully not only enriching the entrepreneurs, but also the scientists who made the original discoveries
mm-hmm.
and who took those discoveries from their laboratories, supported by taxpayers' money, and founded Genentech and Amgen and many other well-known biotechnology companies with materials that they isolated in their taxpayer-supported laboratories and used to found these other companies. That also became a major issue during my lawsuit because the originators of those companies that I mentioned were willing to file and asked to file amicus briefs in support of my position. Mm. Otherwise, they would not have been able to start those companies. And it was later decided by Ronald Reagan through executive order that anything discovered using taxpayers' money in research institutions could be exploited commercially.
Mm-hmm.
That was later incorporated in federal legislation. So it became a commonplace thing to do in subsequent years.
Fascinating, really fascinating.
I should also mention that the vaccine, this is my final statement.
Go for it.
Well, two final statements. The other one is that I also found, in addition to that microscope, a way of producing powdered media for growing cell cultures, which is a huge industry. It's a multi-billion dollar industry today. And that discovery was described in Nature magazine, give it away freely to companies who, as I've indicated, established a billion dollar industry of powdered media used in cell culture worldwide. The final thing that I'll say is that the vaccines produced in WI38 worldwide consist of vaccines against every common human virus disease. I won't list all of them, including some that are not so common, like the adenovirus,
mm-hmm.
Hepatitis A, and all of the other ones that most viewers will be familiar with.
Sure.
Those vaccines produced in WI38 have benefited at least 2 billion people worldwide, has saved 428 million lives in this country alone, and that's all been documented in the scientific literature. I have the only thing I've ever received in payment from a vaccine manufacturer was one time Pfizer, who produced Diplovax, the polio vaccine produced in WI38. Pfizer, a couple of leaders at Pfizer Labs with whom I had interacted as a consultant, took my wife and I to a nice dinner in New York. Thank you, Pfizer.
Yeah, that was a good dinner.
It wasn't $2 billion worth.
Well, let's go forward then to what a lot of people feel is going to be more than a few billion dollars, and that is this evolving space of longevity biotechnology. You wrote a paper quite recently, the greatest risk factor for the leading cause of death is ignored. It's in biogerontology, the Journal of Biogerontology. You talk about a lot of themes that I've seen you lecture on in terms of sort of your definitions of aging and longevity and sort of the connection between one sort of catabolic process of aging and one anabolic genome-driven process of longevity. And then obviously this interest in focusing in the future on longevity determinants and sort of this milieu within the cells that changes over time, the physics that are happening within the cells of the different energetic states of the biomolecules. Take us out a bit, if you would, to the next part of your career in solving or dealing with this issue of death, which we, we lose 65 million or so people a year due to death. And it's all driven for the most part by aging. Of course, people do get hit by cars and struck by lightning, but a large chunk of that are these age-related diseases. Where's Len Hayflick taking us into the future? Where do you see the potential based on what you outlined in this recent paper as where you're going to take the industry now?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that there is any reasonable likelihood, that is, that the probabilities are as close to zero as you can get, that anyone will find a way to interfere with the fundamental process of aging, an effort that the human civilization has tried to do since recorded history 3,500 years ago.
Sure.
I won't go into all of the efforts. Many of them, by today's scientific standards, were crazy ideas. So let's not consider any of them. None of them, obviously, have ever been successful. I don't believe that it is possible to intervene with the process of aging, because it is a universal property of all matter, including all matter in the universe, living or non-living. The underlying reason is the second law of thermodynamics, that is, that energy tends to dissipate or spread out unless it's constrained. the constraining in living material are chemical bonds. So that if you believe that, and I happen to believe it along with many other people now, the likelihood of intervening in a law of physics and violating that law is very, very unlikely. What is more likely and more and perhaps equally beneficial is to discover why diseases are, as you properly stated, that is, the leading causes of death, are age-associated. If they're age-associated, then why aren't we doing research on the etiology of aging in biological material? And that's the basis for the paper that you described. There is no institution in this country or abroad with the word aging in their title that is supporting any research on trying to understand the etiology of aging in biological material. Now, putting aside the likelihood of actually intervening in the process, which I, as I've indicated, seems to me to be terribly unlikely, the plus side of it is that if we can understand the molecular landscape of young cells as distinguished from the molecular landscape of old cells or cells at the end of a lineage of cells, then that could reveal why old cells are more vulnerable to pathology than are young cells. That doesn't take much of a leap of intellect to appreciate. And it could also explain what everybody says, and that is that these pathologies are age associated. That is, there must be something about the molecular arrangements in old cells that increase their vulnerability to pathology. And that landscape determination is doable. We have the technology today. I won't go into all of the technology because I can't recite it from memory, but it's in the public scientific literature. But there are methods for understanding the shape of molecules, of molecules that have to do with life, that is biomolecules, their size, their structure, their appearance, how they move because they're in constant motion, so that that technology exists to do just as I said. And that's where the research should lie. The other interesting phenomenon about the startup companies that you mentioned, and of course there are hundreds of them, in following them, I've learned the following. They all start out with the belief that we've reached a level of scientific understanding today that will permit us to interfere with the fundamental process of aging. Well, that belief has been held for centuries by scientists or others in former centuries for the same reason. They believe that at that time, the level of understanding of life was such that they could find a way to interfere with the process of aging. So we have that phenomenon existing up until this day. People argue that, well, that was also said about landing somebody on the moon, but that has happened. Well, that's correct, but the principles of physics on how to get to the moon and the mathematics were known. We don't understand the physics and the mathematics of the landscape of molecules and old cells to be able to make that claim today. But what has happened is that as startup companies claiming to wanting to interfere with the aging process, including Calico, by the way, for whom I was asked to address their senior leadership several years ago about this question, because they started out wanting to do the same thing. All of them, after discovering the relative or the close to impossibility of tampering with the fundamental aging process, then migrate to conducting research on age-associated diseases. And if you look at all of those companies that have matured enough, like Calico and many others, you'll find that their basic interest today is in age-associated diseases, which puts them in competition with big pharma. So good luck for the little startups in respect to competing with big pharma. This is a very serious problem. This lack of realization on the part of organizations with the word aging in their titles, with their lack of interest, despite the fact that all of their leaders say to a person that the greatest risk factor for the National Cancer Institute, National Institute of Heart and Lung Disease, for the American Cancer Society, for the Heart Association, for Alzheimer's Association, go on and on and on. And I've quoted each one of the leaders saying that the greatest risk factor for the disease in which they're interested is aging. Well, as I pointed out so many times, it doesn't take a great leap of intellect to ask the next question, then why aren't you conducting research on the fundamental biology of aging? And so far, the answer has been silence.
Coming a little full circle, you know, obviously, going back to the mycoplasmology and your discovery of walking pneumonia, atypical pneumonia, and so forth, there's been so much recent that have come, you know, beyond that work in terms of how these mycoplasma, which are, you know, probably one of the lesser understood groups of microorganisms, have pathogenicity and not only sexually transmitted diseases, but potential link to infertility, certain types of cancers. And we've touched on the topic of the microbiome on previous shows. I'm just interested if you've come across interesting pockets of research in mycoplasmology that you find are interesting, whether it have to do with the diseases of aging or other pathologies that you know, we've had a hard time with for the last several decades, but maybe mycoplasma is something, a basket of targets of interest, whether for killing them or maybe having some microbiome benefit. Anything interesting there that you've seen throughout the years?
Yes, the major interest in the mycoplasmas is not only from my first discovery of their association with the human disease, but subsequent findings of their probable association with urogenital tract infections in humans. And that has occupied the attention, and still does occupy the attention, of many labs worldwide. The mycoplasmas happen to be amenable to the diseases caused by mycoplasmas happen to be amenable to treatment with broad spectrum antibiotics, so that the failure to produce a vaccine against mycoplasma pneumoniae, for example, which is the name I gave to my discovery of the cause of primary HF pulmonia. There were attempts to make a vaccine, but they never succeeded. I think that the attempt has been abandoned because of the efficacy of some broad-spectrum antibiotics, because Mycoplasma pneumoniae has evolved in many situations to be resistant to some of those antibiotics, but new ones are emerging. However, the main area of interest for decades, since the discovery of these organisms in the 1800s by Nocard and Roux, is that they cause an enormous number of diseases in lower animals, and in particular in important domestic animals, in chickens and in bovines and in pigs, all of which are important economically to humans. And the diseases that they cause reduces their marketability, because they're frequently not fatal, but debilitating, and are found to exist in many countries still in the world, but not in the United States. We have been very successful in keeping the pneumonic conditions in the animals that I mentioned out of this country. They are found mostly on the Iberian Peninsula, in Africa, in Asia. The Australians and New Zealanders have been pretty successful also in keeping mycoplasma-caused diseases from commercially important domestic animals. But it's a huge industry of prevention.
Go ahead. No, I didn't interrupt.
Well, I was just going to say the obvious, and that is that the interest, most of the interest today in the mycoplasmas are by veterinary researchers. Although there are certainly medical entities interested in treating Mycoplasma pneumoniae, respiratory disease, and also urogenital tract diseases.
Len, while I have you, I can't let you go without getting your top line on COVID. Obviously, you know, we're coming towards some threshold. I don't know when that threshold's going to be, when these first phase three studies are going to open up, and we'll see what's what. But can you give us any top line Len Hayflick insights on where you think we're going with this in terms of single shot vaccines, multiple administrations, WI38 involvement in producing large amounts of it for the world? Give us some Len Hayflick COVID insights, if you would, while I have you.
Well, I can't start to give you some insights without mentioning that I was associated with a group of British researchers in the discovery of one of the first coronaviruses. And that was a common cold virus that I discovered along with these associates. This has been published in Lancet magazine in 1963 or 1962. And so I do have that early history of interest. But anyhow, to answer your question directly, I've been fascinated with the sad part of this whole story of COVID viruses, or SARS viruses, I should say, in respect to the emergence of instant virologists an instant epidemiologist, and the nonsense that they have presented to the public without any understanding of either of those fields. It simply is an example of the human condition more than it is of anything else, and how people want to be expert instantaneously in areas that they have total, in which they have total ignorance. So that's one part of this whole story that has been intriguing in that revelation. But as far as the practical aspects are concerned, it's likely that a vaccine or two or three will be developed using the new technology which has emerged since my days when I first produced vaccines against polio. Excuse me. And I was the first, I was a senior author on a paper along with Stanley and others and Hillary, in which we described the production of the first polio vaccine produced in human diploid, in normal human fetal cells. So I do have a intimate association, not only with viruses, which I have worked for several decades, but also with taking a virus from the laboratory bench to FDA licensure, which I don't think anyone today has had yet. So I know all of the aspects of vaccine development pretty intimately. The likelihood of producing a vaccine against COVID-19, I think, is pretty good. It will not happen, at least if my crystal ball is accurate and based on my experience, until well into next year. There is also some serious problems in respect to distribution of the vaccine. We're already faced with so-called anti-vaxxers, people who will not take even current vaccines. I don't know of a vaccine against COVID-19 that is being considered to be made in WI-38 or any normal human cell, mainly for the reason that the modern technology where you can make vaccines without using cell cultures to a large extent are possible. And also because of the wide belief on the part of very religious people who will not accept a vaccine produced in a cell derived from a human fetus, despite the fact that that fetus, like the WI-38 derived fetus, would have otherwise been incinerated. So the question is it, in the case of WI-38, is it better to lose a half a billion lives of people in order not to incinerate the tissue? Very simple question.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the COVID vaccines, there are two of the vaccines that are in competition today are in fact tested on cells that were derived from a human fetus. So they're called 293 cells derived from human fetal kidney and immortalized with adenovirus. With an adenovirus construct, and that has been published and could possibly be the basis for the refusal of people who believe in the who believe that that genes, because they're tested using 293 cells. But I believe that there's a good likelihood that a vaccine will be made and be available toward the middle or end of next year. The other serious consideration is based on the mutability of this virus, and that has been clearly demonstrated that it could turn out to be something like the flu, that we will have to prepare a vaccine against new antigenic properties of this vaccine on a periodic basis for years to come, as we currently do with the flu virus vaccines. That seems to me to be a real, a good probability, as unpleasant as it sounds, but hopefully the vaccines will be effective against them. I also need to comment on this concept of herd immunity.
Okay.
Many people now realize the stupidity of this the current belief by one of Trump's leading medical authorities who's running the his alleged vaccine program at the moment, or virus program at the moment, that herd immunity can be depended upon to solve this problem. It cannot, at least without unless we produce good vaccines. This gentleman is maintaining that the disease should be allowed to spread sufficiently enough to have antibody levels raised in, let's say, 75% of our population, which would then provide the remaining 25% with immunity, because the virus would not be able to escape from the 75% who would be either dead or kept alive as a result of their better immune systems. So that notion, and it's been that notion of herd immunity has been objected to by almost all of the serious virologists who are in authority today. So I don't think there's much more to be said about that, other than to, I think, have the basis for alleging mass murder attributable to the present administration in this country for their behavior in respect to this COVID-19 virus disease. Their neglect and failure to adhere to scientific principles in this field have had them, in my judgment, and I know in the judgment of other people, guilty of mass murder. I doubt that that notion is going to go anywhere, but I think it has to be said.
It's been really a fascinating time listening to you. Really an honor you taking this much time out of your schedule to talk about everything you've done. It's so inspiring, and just wishing you the best with everything that you're doing now moving forward. For everybody that's going to be listening on the various podcast networks or watching on the YouTube channel, you've been listening to the amazing Dr. Leonard Hayflick, a gentleman who has laid the groundwork for most of the major discoveries in cell biology, virus vaccine development, mycoplasmology over the last half a century. Len, thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to come talk.
Well, thank you very much, Ira. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to the day when, after discovering that you are a fellow Philadelphian, that conditions will be such that I can visit you in Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
And I hope that day is sooner rather than later.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Thank you again. It's been a very interesting to speak with you, and especially to have the opportunity to have very intelligent questions asked, which is not common in my experience.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that.